Hi everyone, and welcome to this new episode of With a Galactica per Physiotherapisti interviews. Today we're really happy to have with us Jason Silvernail. Hi Jason.
Hey, how are you? It's great to be with you today. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really excited to get into the podcast here.
Thanks, Jason. And I know you have to give us a disclaimer before you can start the interview.
Yes, thank you very much. So I want to make sure everybody knows I'm here as Dr. Silvernail, not Colonel Silvernail. And so I'm on active duty in the U.S. military, in the U.S. Army. And so everything I talk about with you today is my personal opinion and commentary. It doesn't reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense, or the United States government. This is just my opinions only.
Okay. Thanks, Jason. So today we're going to cover a lot of topics with Jason. We're going to talk about the biopsychosocial approach, the imaging, pain, manual therapy. So a lot of topics to cover. But as always, Jason, we normally start by our guest speakers introducing themselves to our community. So if you could please tell us something about your background, your education, but also your professional experience, both as a clinician and as a researcher.
Yeah, thanks very much for this opportunity. So my name is Jason Silvernail. I've been in physical therapy since 1997 when I qualified. I have a clinical doctorate, a doctor of physical therapy degree. I also have a PhD from Baylor University. The Army sent me to school for training. I'm board certified in orthopedic physical therapy. I'm fellowship trained in manual therapy, and I'm also a certified strength and conditioning specialist, so I know some of the fitness and conditioning aspects of rehabilitation. So, I've been in practice since 97. I've been in the U.S. Army. I've worked with a wide variety of patients, mostly orthopedic and sports medicine cases, some post-operative orthopedic surgeries, more than I would like to see. But a lot of different other things. I've done some inpatient care. I've done some neurological rehab. I've done a little bit of amputee medicine. So it's kind of a wide variety of different places in terms of patient experiences and patient groups that I've worked with. I have published a little bit of original research for my dissertation, which was the biomechanics of manual therapy for knee osteoarthritis, and knee and hip osteoarthritis treatment is the specialty of the fellowship program that I graduated from. And so we could talk a little bit about that if you'd like. And I've also published a few commentaries, articles, and I've been an author on several evidence summary panels for the Department of Defense as well, summarizing the evidence on overweight and obesity, lower pain. And so I've been involved generating research through my PhD program. I've written on sort of commenting on it and the application of that research. And I've also had some time and experience on panel groups that summarize evidence, and provide clinical practice guidelines too. So I think it's a pretty well balanced, research background too. So, my current interests are, I think, what they always have been, which is practically applicable things, taking this huge complex body of literature and body of ideas and making them practically relevant for people today. And so that's really what I try to bring to the table. I try to summarize a lot of that and give people things they can actually use in practice, and not just, ideas to talk about.
Yeah, thanks. And that's definitely something that we're going to discuss today. My first question is more about the biopsychosocial approach. Obviously, a lot more literature is driving our practice towards this approach. But what does it really mean for us as physiotherapists, but also how can we realize it in our daily practice?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think a lot has been written about what the biopsychosocial model is or what it's about. Let me kind of take a cue. One of the things we just talked about was I want to be practically relevant to people. I want to give them information they can immediately use. In my mind, a big part of what the biopsychosocial model does is it helps us realize that there are many things that a patient's clinical course beyond just the state of their tissue. So whether or not their tissue is healthy or ill or what disorder they have when they come to see us, that's only one piece of the puzzle. We have many, many other factors to consider. And as we think about all these factors and whether or not some of them are within our control or some of them are within our ability to help the patient control, the biopsychosocial framework provides a framework where we can start to understand what some of those things are and whether or not we can help the patient to improve those and therefore improve their experience with their disorder or their problem. I think that's the biggest piece. Instead of seeing it as something really complex, see it as like this is our way to start understanding.
Sorry, Jason, you froze for the last few seconds.
Okay, let me check on my end here.
It's just that happened before, but like I just lost you for I think the last few words you said in the sentence.
Okay, how's my quality now? I'm pretty close to my internet router, and God knows I pay for good internet. I've gone through here, and let me close off a couple of programs that might be running. I have a pretty modern computer, so I'm hopeful that that's not a big feature. How about now?
You probably missed the last two words, but it's difficult to redo it. So I'll just let you know, but yeah, we'll carry on the interview.
So I think, you know, to summarize what I was saying before is that I think about the biopsychosocial, I think of that as a framework or an idea help us understand how many different factors. Whoops. Okay. So tell you what, let me move closer to my router, right?
Yeah. Cool.
Let's do that. You know what? We could try closing down and coming back up and restarting too. So I'm not sure why we're having trouble, but we are. So Okay, I'm wondering how that seems to you, video quality wise.
Video quality is fine. And it's just up to you if you're happy for people to see your bedroom. Like that's
well, I don't. I'm not sure how many more options we've got.
It's up to you. Like I mean,
one of the things I can do. Let me try. Not the biggest fan of that either. Give me a second to think. Yeah, let's try one other room. Give me a sec here. How are you doing on time? What kind of time have you got for this and all that stuff?
I haven't got nothing else to do, so it's fine.
Okay. All right, let me try moving to another room. Not sure why we're having troubles here, but okay. I'm just in the next room from my router, so I don't know why we're having the trouble we're having. But All right. I think this is okay background wise.
Yeah.
What is this like for you video quality wise?
Good. Yeah. Really good. Yeah.
So what do you want to do here? Do you want to redo the biopsychosocial question or do you want to just keep?
Or if you want to just restart from when you said to summarize.
Okay.
Part of the question.
That'd be great. That'd be great. So you're doing the editing, so I'll give you a little bit of a pause here. So basically, to summarize what I'm talking about is I think the biopsychosocial model provides us a framework to be able to see all the different factors that affect our patients' ability to recover from their problem and to think about the different factors that there are that we may be able to help with ourselves, or we may be able to help coach a patient to improve while they're in our care to maximize their outcome. Right. So it helps get us beyond this. Oh, they have a problem here. The only thing that matters is the health of this tissue here. Nothing else matters. We know that that's not true. And the biopsychosocial model gives us a framework to understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I really like this image of the biopsychosocial approaches as a puzzle. Yeah. It really makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely.
My next question will be more on treatment in particular. Like physiotherapy has always been very highly linked with manual therapy. But we know manual therapy is kind of an umbrella term. So there's not a lot of meanings. So what I want to ask you is, what is the role of manual therapy at the moment? But also, if you could clarify to us, because we often see people talking about hands-on and hands-off. So what does it really mean?
Well, I think that's a great question. I know that right now it's really popular to talk about manual therapy, especially right now it's popular to talk about how manual therapy doesn't have any benefit for people and none of us should do it. And let me be clear, I don't agree with that. I think that's far off base. And let me explain why. So I think the best way for me to open this conversation is to talk to you about a letter to the editor I wrote. I actually responded to Robin McKenzie. And the title of my letter to the editor was Manual Therapy, Process or Product. And so I see manual therapy the way I was taught in my manual therapy program. Manual therapy is a process of care, of reasoning, and of making clinical decisions. Whether I put my hands on the patient or not, it's a thought process. We talked before about how biopsychosocial model is a framework that helps us make better decisions for our patients, right? So I see manual therapy the same way. It is a framework that helps me reason through a problem with patients, right? Whether I actually apply a technique to that patient or not is a separate issue entirely. And I found that after I went through subspecialty training in manual therapy, a big part of that was a very rigorous clinical critical thinking component. And that helped me make better decisions for my patients across a range of different things. So I think that if we look through manual therapy through a very narrow concept and we only see whether it's touching patients or not touching patients, I think that's a off-base way to see it. I don't understand manual therapy that way at all. It's a framework that helps me make better decisions. I will often see patients. Every patient I see and I work with, I take a history on, I examine, whatever I do, that's a manual therapy approach. Whether I put my hands on them to treat them or not is a separate issue. So after manual therapy subspecialty training, there are some kind of problems that I treat with my hands a lot more often, right? Neck pain, shoulder pain, a couple of other things I can think of, right? And some things less, like the lumbar spine. Like I don't use a whole lot of manual therapy for the lumbar spine anymore, right? So these are different things that I've come to over time. And it's important, I think, for everyone to realize that manual therapy is more than whether you do a technique to someone or not. That's just a very elementary way to see that issue. And I can recommend the manual therapy program I went through, which is based on the Maitland clinical reasoning system from Jeffrey Maitland. And I think there's most of what is in Jeffrey Maitland's books. If you don't read an article about him online or hear what somebody has to say about him, if you actually read what he wrote, that his books, they are packed full of amazing clinical insights that are applicable to you, whether you treat patients with your hands or not.
Okay, and then yeah, we'll definitely put the reference for your article.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting paper. Then my next question would be more on diagnosis, but in particular on the relation between imaging and diagnosis, because what happens is very often, like, the imaging reveals something that we doesn't really match with our objective assessment of the patient. So yeah. What I want to ask you is, it's obviously really difficult for physiotherapists to then communicate that to the patient. So how do you normally discuss with your patients the correlation between the imaging findings and pain?
Well, I think I probably use a lot of examples that I've pulled from other people that I haven't invented myself. One of the things that I like to talk to patients about is a lot of the imaging changes that we see, especially in advanced imaging, CT and MRI. They're giving us much more high fidelity images, but more of the imaging findings there are questionably relevant clinically. And so I would say your MRI shows that your spine has gray hair and wrinkles, right? And these are, I have gray hair and wrinkles, but my face doesn't hurt. It's a normal part of the aging process, right? So some of those are normal. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is the imaging tells you what you look like, not what you feel like. So if I take your picture right now, I can tell you what you look like, but I can't tell how you feel inside. You might feel happy, you might feel sad, you might feel well rested, you might feel tired, you might feel a little bit ill or not. I can't tell any of that by the photo unless the feelings are really extreme. And that's a good way to see imaging. Right? If I see an extreme imaging finding or a large, significant imaging finding, that's much more likely to be relevant to the patient's problem. And so that the camera, the picture metaphor, I find is pretty helpful for people too. A big part of what we do when patients come to us having had imaging is making sure we put that imaging finding in context for the patient, helping them understand, is it relevant or not to them? How relevant and how we make a decision about that. That is a huge part of the education that we need to be giving the patient and that we need to be helping the patient understand. That's a really, really important thing that we'll do. And I remember being tired early in my career. I'm just tired of having to explain people's MRI results. Yeah, 20 years later, here I am still, right? And so our ability to be okay with that and to be good at it and to present it in a scientifically valid and positive way, super important.
Yeah, definitely. And so what we always say in Italy is sometimes we have these people really carrying a suitcase full of imaging.
Oh, yeah. Here's my reports.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm even here. I have a herniated disc.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the thing sometimes, like fighting as well what they've been told by other people. As well, that's really challenging.
Right, it's a challenging thing. I would say that I think for people who are really focused on their imaging results, like, I don't talk about it with them early on. I try to give them some experience with me first. If they come in and I say, yeah, that other doctor was crazy, I'm the doctor that knows what he's talking about. Your results mean X. I'm just another guy with an opinion, yeah. Right? But if I take some time to build up a relationship with that patient and we have a track record with each other, my credibility level increases. And then I have more time to talk them through that. And then we kind of revisit that later. I don't have to have that conflict on day one, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And then just obviously our last question for today, it's very related to what you said at the beginning of make things practical. And so it's all about how we can transfer like the research into practice. And that's something that obviously we talk a lot about having an evidence-based approach on our channel. Yeah. And a lot of our followers ask us, okay, but yeah, we're reading research, but then how can we actually use it in our practices? So that's the question that I'm going to forward to you.
Yeah, I would... I think we look at this too closely, when we think about evidence and practice, I think too often we get too detailed with it. So let me give you an example. So the primary way that we check quality of care in the clinics that I work in is through peer review. So a peer reviews the notes you did with the patient, right? I think most everywhere in physiotherapy world, wherever you are in the world, some kind of peer review is a normal part of running a clinic. I'm hopeful that you would agree and that you understand what that means, right? So when I read a patient's, when I read a colleague's note, I'm asking myself, is this evidence-based care? And I'm not down into the tiny details. I want to think big picture. So for example, if I review a colleague's note and it seems to be a shoulder, a mechanical type of shoulder problem, maybe we call that impingement, maybe we call it subacromial syndrome, maybe we call it rotator cuff tendonite, whatever we call it. I don't think the name is that important, honestly. What does the evidence say we should be using to care for those patients in clinical practice guidelines? I've been an author on clinical practice guidelines before, and it's very helpful because it brings people up. And instead of getting down into the details, it helps people see the big picture. And so in the big picture, what I'm looking for in my colleague's note is I'm looking for education that is scientifically valid, right? Maybe an explanation of the MRI, right? Like we just talked about, if one was done. I'm looking for mobility exercises for the shoulder to improve the range of motion and strength training for the shoulder. Now, if we have other things added onto that, like a manual technique or needling or taping, some people like to scrape people with metal bars lately. I don't know what's up with that. Okay, no problem. If that's additional, okay. I would consider that evidence-based care, right? And so I think that we spend too much time arguing about the tiny details and not enough time seeing the big picture. Is the care active? Is it active care? Is the patient doing most of the effort? Are they going through an education process? Are we working on goals that matter to the patient? Does it involve active exercise type therapy or active physical activity therapy in some way? In my mind, that's what really pushes something to be evidence-based. If we do all of that and we have some other things added, okay, I'm okay with that. I think about therapy like a buffet, right? You have main courses and you have side dishes, right? Nobody goes to a buffet and gets a plate full of broccoli, right? Now, I like broccoli as much as the next guy. But broccoli's a side dish. It's not a main dish, right? So if your main dish has your roast and your potatoes, and you have maybe some Brussels sprouts and asparagus and like a little slice of pie on the side, no problem. But if you come back with a plate that only has pie on it, that's not a meal, right? And so if I see that same colleague that with that patient with mechanical shoulder problem, and it's all needling and not much of anything else, I don't think that's evidence-based anymore because we've lost the education component and the active therapy component to that care. And I think some of the best things that I think everyone should be familiar with when it comes to evidence is clinical practice guidelines. Not even the individual research studies. They change a lot and they are important. They are important. But I think what's more important is clinical practice guidelines put out by usually your professional society or something like that, that helps you understand what the big picture of evidence is and how to go about putting it into practice. I think we spend overall too much time on the tiny details and not enough time on the big picture movements, on the big picture concepts that we need to work with our patients. And I think that as a result, we are too intolerant of tiny variations in practice between people. And I think that promotes a lot of conflict, right? Especially when you can't see someone, especially when you're on a screen and you're typing, right? And we're very, very mad at each other for doing the wrong little thing. I've lost a lot of that. I don't care about a lot of those little things anymore. I care about the big things. And if someone is treating the patient with kindness and care, they're educating them about their problem, they're working on goals the patient cares about, and the primary part of the therapy is active and self-care minded, in my mind, that's evidence-based. Anything else we put on top of that is just a side dish. And a little extra broccoli never hurt anybody.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Plenty of great examples today to bring to our daily practice for sure. Yeah, this was our last question. Just Jason, if someone is interested in following your work, what are the best platforms to follow you on social media?
Yeah, so you can find me anywhere people are that's a popular social media output. I'm there. My handle is at Jason Silvernail, all one word. You can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on LinkedIn, on TikTok, and on YouTube. And I talk about practice in general, but I talk a lot about healthcare leadership and conflict management too. And if you follow me there and you've heard something that you heard from me today that you liked and you want me to talk more about it or ask questions, please come find me on social media and ask questions, and maybe we'll do a video about it.
Thanks. Thanks again, Jason. It's been great to have you here today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And thanks, everyone, to follow this episode. And we hope to see you soon. Bye.
What do you think? How did that go?